DW Deutsche Welle. World in Progress.
Today on the program, overcoming a common birth defect and helping kids to walk in Tanzania.
It's transformational, and especially for children who are older and who have had to live for such a long time with the debilitating and painful condition of clubfoot.
A new law to control traditional healers is raising concern among Senegal's medical doctors.
It has no foundation, no scientific basis to make it a medical practice that can really solve the population's health problems. We're not refusing to collaborate or work complementarily, but we need to define the framework.
And fishermen from the Easter Island learn to adapt to new lifestyles.
We didn't want the government to stop us fishing completely. It's important for us and for future generations. So now we have agreed on an area that will have multiple uses, which means we can continue with our ancestral and artisan fishing.
Welcome to World in Progress. In Bonn, Germany, I'm Anke Raspar. Who do you consult when you're sick? Do you go to a doctor or first try a traditional healer? That choice, of course, depends on many factors. For instance, what kind of medical practitioner is available in your proximity? In Senegal, most people have easier access to one of the some 10,000 traditional healers. They usually combine a mix of rituals, prayer and medicinal plants when treating their patients. While some prescriptions can actually help patients, the lack of any laws to regulate traditional medicine makes it easier for fake healers to exploit patients instead of curing them. That's why Senegal is now planning a new law to regulate the practices of the traditional healers in the country. But many medical doctors say the law does not go far enough. Emmanuel Landet has more from Dakar.
Ça, c'est le pic de Acacia albida.
This is Acacia albira. It is used for mystical cleansing rites, to protect ourselves against evil spirits, against the jinns, against all bad spirits.
Abdoulaye Sané wants to be a traditional healer. The young man in his 30s hasn't been to medical school, but his father, who was also a healer, taught him all he knew about healing and treating patients with plants. Today he's exploring the wild-looking garden at the Cœur Massar Hospital of Traditional Medicine in the greater Dakar suburb. Shrubs and trees grow intertwined here. Thickets often block the narrow dirt path.
I came to learn about nature and trees to become a healer because my parents were healers. They healed with plants. I want to carry on what they started and to be able to better serve people. That's why I've come to learn.
The hospital was opened in 1980 by a French botanist and biologist, Yvette Parès, to treat leprosy. Later, the use of plants was developed to treat other diseases as leprosy became less widespread. The hospital garden functions much like a botanical garden. It's open to anyone who wants to learn about medicinal plants informally. There's no real teaching method, and what is taught is unregulated. Moussa Diallo is an expert in medicinal plants at the traditional hospital. He says at the moment there's no way of confirming how much medical knowledge traditional healers really have.
There are traditional practitioners who work without structure, who work in their homes. A lot of the time we're not sure of their knowledge. Often they are healers who aren't trained, who are self-taught. This is frequently a problem.
If the draft law is passed, traditional practitioners will have to meet a set criteria and prove their knowledge of herbs and plants in front of a panel of experts to earn a license to practice. They have to prove that they come from a family of healers with a good track record, that they have a fixed place to practice and aren't nomads, and that they're affordable and easily accessible. When he leaves the hospital, Abdoulaye Sané won't walk out with any credentials or certificates, but he'll be more familiar with the healing powers of plants. But today, there's no one to control if he and thousands of other healers like him across the country will successfully treat his patients. Back in Dakar, Dr. Mamadou Kar is spokesperson for a group of some 4,000 doctors made up of orthodontists, neurosurgeons, pharmacists and vets. They say they weren't consulted in drafting the law and want it withdrawn because it doesn't identify what qualifies as traditional healing and it's not sound enough from a medical perspective.
Once we know who's who does what, we can regulate it. We're not refusing to collaborate or work complementarily, but we need to define the framework.
Identifying traditional healers as well as the depth of their knowledge will be very problematic, says Dr. Carr.
Who is a practitioner? It's everyone. He who practices the rites. He who inherited it from his grandfather. He who does magic. Who's a sorcerer, even if you want. So it has no foundation, no scientific basis to make it a medical practice that can really solve the population's health problems.
According to the WHO, 85% of Africans consult traditional healers. Though some genuinely help their patients, Mamadou Kar says this isn't a reason to pass it into law. He says he's constantly faced with the afflictions caused by traditional healers.
You see someone who has a dislocation of the mandible, the jaw. So the person opens their mouth and they simply can't close it. You know what the traditional practitioner says? He'll say it's someone who has been slapped by a jinn, a devil. You see? But this is extremely serious.
Abdoulaye Ndao, the president of the Senegalese Federation of Practitioners of Traditional Medicine, says he's aware there are charlatans who exploit people's vulnerability and the deeply rooted beliefs in occult practices.
It is our culture. People believe in it. And there's an effectiveness in certain illnesses. But we've noticed that there's a massive number of so-called traditional practitioners. That's why it's necessary and urgent that the traditional medicine sector gets permits to regulate it.
If the majority of people resort to traditional doctors, it's also because there's more of them. Around 10,000 healers altogether, but mostly outside big African capital cities like Dakar. Most people don't have health insurance and simply cannot afford good medical care. And, well, it costs less to see a healer in your village and pay a couple of francs for roots, herbs and a few prayers than paying transport costs to get to the nearest city hospital, let alone afford prescription medication. As Joseph Mendy, a neurosurgeon in the Doctors Consortium, is all too aware. Outside of Dakar, his specialty doesn't exist.
When someone struggles to buy his breakfast, how are you going to tell him to pay for tests? But that sick person is told that there's someone who can heal you. Can you blame him for going? And after, you'll hear, ah, yes, if people go and see these traditional practitioners, it's because the traditional practitioners do a good job, so we have to legalize this. Well, no.
The draft law is currently under revision by the Council of Ministers. No date for its adoption has been set. Doctors, both modern and traditional, are agreed on one thing, however. Better healthcare that puts patients' health and safety first is needed in the country. For DW, Emmanuel Landet in Dakar, Senegal.
Not being able to walk well hampers people's ability to go to school or to work and impacts on their whole life. That's what many children who are born with clubfoot, one of the most common birth defects worldwide, face. Clubfoot can be treated, but while in rich countries with good health systems, the problem is corrected when the kids are young. That's often not possible for children in rural Africa. In Tanzania, that is starting to change, and an increasing number of children there are getting the necessary treatment to cure this condition, as Julia Gross discovered. Her report is presented by Nick Martin.
So the foot was in an equinous position, facing downwards, and we've already isolated and cut the Achilles tendon. Here we've got the nervus tibialis, that's the nerve leading to the sole. We've opened the upper ankle joint from the back, and now it's possible to move the foot out of this downward-looking position pretty well.
Anne-Marie Schrammel, an orthopaedic surgeon from Nuremberg in Germany, is standing in a brightly lit operating theatre in the Nkoranga Hospital in Uzu River on the slopes of Mount Meru in northern Tanzania. The German doctor is performing surgery on 13-year-old Hassan Salim Meyer. The boy has had problems walking all of his life because of clubfoot. Schrammel and her team have been coming to this hospital regularly for almost 20 years to perform orthopaedic surgeries.
This is going to look a bit brutal.
Approximately 1 in 1,000 babies is born with clubfoot. It's one of the most common birth defects worldwide. One foot, or as in about half of all cases, both feet, are pointing downwards and inwards. And patients like Hassan can only walk on the edge or even on the top of the affected foot. They can't wear normal shoes and they can't walk long distances. In Europe and the US, children usually begin treatment right after they are born. By the time they are 3 or 4 years old, their feet are corrected and they can walk normally. But in poor countries like Tanzania, clubfoot often stays untreated, with grave consequences, as Sarah Raymond explains.
A lot of the times the children who are coming into us have never had any kind of education before because they can't walk to school, can't walk 7 or 10 kilometres to go to school. Or even if the school is close by, the parents don't want them to be out and seen in the community.
Raymond is the director and founder of the Plaster House in Arusha, a place where children are taken care of before and after orthopaedic surgeries. If medical problems go untreated, these kids often face a life in poverty because it's hard for them to find a job and most lack education. On top of that, children with clubfoot face discrimination.
The way people perceive disability almost changes tribe by tribe by tribe. So there are still some tribes here, if a child is born with a disability, that the child will be killed. You know, there are too many stories of the mother having a child with a disability and dad's gone, you know, because the mother's the one who's brought the bad luck into the family by having the child with a disability. It also depends on the people's level of education. You know, do they have the education to understand that having a child with a disability is actually okay? You know, and there's a lot of people, especially out in the villages, who just don't have that level of education.
And even if people know they can get treatment, many are unable to afford it. Or there is no clinic close by that provides care for clubfoot patients. Many parents might not even know the condition is treatable at all. This was also the case for Hassan. He's sitting on his hospital bed with a huge cast on his leg the day after his surgery.
I didn't know it was possible to do something about my foot. We have relatives who live near the plaster house. When I visited them, the people from the plaster house called my parents and arranged everything. Now I'm really anxious to see my foot. When I return home, I want to learn more, do more studying. I want to become a pilot.
Getting the right treatment is life-changing for people with clubfoot and also their families, Sarah Raymond says.
It's transformational. I mean, that's just it. And then these corrective surgeries are huge, and especially for children who are older and who have had to live for such a long time with the debilitating and painful condition of clubfoot. Now, after they have the surgery, it doesn't automatically mean that the pain's gone away, and it doesn't automatically mean that they can walk so much further on their newly straightened foot. But they can wear normal shoes. They look normal. And, you know, when we interview children before they start any kind of treatment, that's a lot of it. I don't want to stand out in a crowd because my feet are facing inwards. That's what parents will say about their children.
The power's gone. We used to have that much more often.
The torch is in here.
If we work until late in the evening, we actually might have to use flashlights or headlights. Because the power is not reliable, anaesthetists here use as few devices dependent on electricity as possible.
The conditions in the Coaranga hospital are less than ideal, but with the help of donations, Dr. Schrammel and her team have brought several generators and sterilizers to improve the medical equipment. Like elsewhere in Africa, many qualified physicians in Tanzania leave for big cities or go abroad in search for a better life and a larger salary. That's another reason why there's a lack of qualified doctors in most hospitals, and many of the clubfoot surgeries are done by foreign surgeons working pro bono, like Dr. Schrammel. Orthopaedic impediments are easier to treat the younger the patients are. Babies and toddlers usually don't need a big operation. Corrections can be done with less invasive methods instead. That's why increasing numbers of outpatient clinics or trained midwives now treat small children using the so-called Ponseti technique. With this method, the deformed foot is turned back into its natural position with a series of casts. Each of them stays on for a week. The whole process only takes 3 to 7 weeks, followed by a tenotomy, a very small surgical procedure to lengthen the Achilles tendon. After that, the child has to wear a special brace to keep the foot from relapsing. It's basically two shoes connected with a splint they need to wear 24/7 for 3 months, then every night until the age of 4 or 5. That way, the clubfoot is completely healed before the child starts school. The Ponseti treatment is cheap, about $250 in total, and surprisingly effective, says Anne Madondo, a physiotherapist at the Ouse River Rehabilitation Centre.
When we open the cast, we always ask the parents what they think of the progress. And usually they're very surprised that it's just a simple cast, because obviously when they come to us for the first time, they think, oh, it's going to be a big operation for my child. And they're very scared. They don't know what's happening. The parents are usually so happy, but most of them, they never know what to do to thank us. They sometimes bring a chicken, or they'll bring bananas, and they'll be like, I don't have that much to give, but this is all I have. Please just take it as a token of my appreciation. And that for us is just so satisfying, you know, that we've made a difference in a child's life.
And clearly, getting treatment is also very inspirational for the children themselves, like for 10-year-old Shamimu Mia Kakumi, who had one club foot surgically corrected last year and has now come back to have his other foot corrected.
I'm just very, very happy about my feet. I tell all the other children at the hospital how happy I am. And when I'm grown up, I want to be a doctor.
Held her close, weeping.
Stepping up efforts to treat clubfoot in Tanzania. And that was Nick Martin presenting a report compiled by Julia Groß. You're listening to DW's World in Progress from Bonn, Germany, with me, Anke Raspar. And after a short music break, we'll be back with a story about fishermen in Chile and the Easter Island who are learning to adapt to new lifestyles.
She don't care 'cause she's safe now. These arms were meant for you, and these shoulders meant to carry you. When you call my name, come running. Till then I'll be waiting, I'll be waiting. Oh, 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 oh. Waiting here. Moments pass, she pulls away. Then the moment stops, my heart afraid. Up and we're eye to eye. She whispers, love, never leave my side. Oh.
final story today takes us to fishermen on the Pacific Ocean. The Chilean government recently announced the creation of 3 new marine protected areas, including one surrounding Easter Island that spans some 740,000 square kilometers. That's about the same size as Chile's total land area. People from the island now want to learn from fishing communities in the north of Chile, who are regarded as pioneers in understanding how to adapt and live alongside marine reserves. Jane Chambers went to meet some of them.
Desde Rapa Nui, con toda esta buena noticia, le queremos dar un pequeño regalo.
Delegates from Easter Island, or Rapa Nui as the locals call it, are celebrating the announcement of the new marine protected area. They're special guests at a recent international congress on marine protected areas. They're also here to talk to local fishing communities about how they've learned to live with marine reserves. The announcement comes after 5 years of tough negotiations, as one of the delegates, Marcela Hay, explains. She's part of the Rapa Nui marine organisation, Tupu.
We didn't want the government to stop us fishing completely. It's important for us and for future generations. So now we have agreed on an area that will have multiple uses, which means we can continue with our ancestral and artisan fishing. Industrial fishing will be banned. We don't want people coming from other regions to use up all our resources. We have used the same fishing methods for many years. We fish using stones. But we do have a problem at the moment with overfishing. Tourists are increasing and they like to eat local produce like tuna fish. Now the local fishermen have decided they want to go back to having restricted areas in which you can't fish. They are called tapu. Podremos lograr que este recurso
no se sobreexplote. And that's something they're doing at a fishing village called Punta de Choros on Chile's coast, a government group called Senapesca that makes sure industrial and artisan fishermen are complying with Chile's fishing regulations have recently set up an office here. Cristian López is the regional director.
The local specialty here is called locos, or Chilean abalone. They're like giant sea snails. Because of overfishing, they were an endangered species. And so now we have authorized restricted areas and quotas for them, and stocks are up. Divers can get them at certain times of the year. This fishing village, Punta de Choros, is a very good place for them.
Although they found it difficult to live with the restricted areas and fishing quotas at first, communities like Punta de Choros have made peace with the marine reserves. Locals like third-generation fisherman Salvador Varaga are now happy with the regulations and quotas on logos and other seafood. He says that now stocks are up, he can get better prices for his products. He dives for logos once a year, and the rest of the time he takes tourists on tours like this one around the rocky, arid islands in the National Reserve.
At first we found having the National Park and Marine Reserve difficult. We used to camp on the island and use it as a base for our fishing, but now we aren't allowed to go there because of the penguins. They get stressed when they see humans, and sometimes they used to jump off the cliffs to their death. So no, the islands are out of bounds to us fishermen. It was also hard only being able to fish at certain times of the year. But then we realized that tourism is a good alternative. I'm very happy to work in tourism. The fishermen here started with 2 boats, and now there are so many tourists. We have 60 boats doing tours around the reserve. We charge $12 per person, and it really helps us now that fishing and diving for seafood is restricted to certain times of the year. I also really love nature. It's great to show people the bottlenose dolphins that live in these waters and the penguins. And I really like some birds called lily cormorants. They are very special. The male mates for life, and if his partner dies, he stays single. But if the male dies, the female will look for a new partner. What do you think about that?
A big topic in fishing communities is how to add value to their products. So fishermen at Punta de Choros built a sea processing plant. It means that they can do everything locally. Dressed in bright white overalls with a net on his hair for hygiene reasons, quality control manager Marco Vasquez explains what they do.
Nosotros trabajamos con jaiba, un cangrejo.
We work with crab. We pre-cook the crab claws here and then freeze them and sell them to places like the United States. Working in an environmentally friendly way is very important to us, so we can take care of our stocks. Because of that, we take off one crab's claw and then release the crab back into the sea because the claw will grow back.
I've come to another fishing village called Caleta de San Pedro, which also have quotas and restricted areas for fishing in place. It's a 2 hours drive down south, and it's famous for saltwater clams, a local speciality. But when stocks dried up, the local women decided to help their husbands, and I'm off to meet some of them. I'm sitting next door to a very lovely lady called Senora Juanita, who's got her chef's hat on and is just outside her kitchen where they've got delicious smelling things coming out. It's a big, big restaurant with lots of different stalls that are offering different types of seafood, and it's looking right out onto the sea. It's just on the beach. How did all this start?
The truth is that we started out of necessity. The clam stocks had dried up and our husbands had no way of making a living. We were housewives before, but we had to start doing something else. So we sold homemade dishes at the local market, and it went so well we moved here to this gastronomic center, where a group of around 12 of us each have a little restaurant. It was tough at first because we missed our children and our husbands didn't like us going out to work. But now we are doing really well and it's been a very good experience.
Despite initial concerns, communities here in the Coquimbo region in the north of Chile have made fishing restrictions caused by overfishing and the marine reserves work for them. They've adapted their way of life by doing tourism, adding value to their products and opening restaurants. They say the key is learning to look after their environment. Jane Chambers, DW, Punta de Choros, Chile.
And that report from the shores of the Pacific Ocean in Chile wraps up today's edition of World in Progress. To listen back or download this report or past episodes, just go to dw.com/worldinprogress or find us on iTunes or on SoundCloud. For more globalization stories, check out DW Global Society on Facebook. World in Progress will be back next week. For today, thanks for your interest. In Bonn, Germany, I'm Anke Raspa. Take care.